How does a changing climate change our minds, brains, and bodies?
Clayton Page Aldern is an award-winning neuroscientist turned environmental journalist whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, The Guardian, The Economist, and Grist, where he is a senior data reporter. A Rhodes Scholar, he holds a master's in neuroscience and a master's in public policy from the University of Oxford. He is also a research affiliate at the Center for Studies in Demography and Ecology at the University of Washington. He's the author of The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Minds, Brains, and Bodies, which explores the neurobiological impacts of rapid environmental change.
Clayton Aldern, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Mia.
So congratulations on the publication of The Weight of Nature. We've just been enjoying it. Before we dive in, I believe you selected a passage to share with our listeners.
Yeah, just a very short excerpt from the introduction, actually, to maybe orient us in the conversation somewhat. The story of your life is a plumb line, which is to say, it has direction. You feel this direction because you point yourself in it every moment of every day. You decide to get out of bed. You decide to brush your teeth, or you decide to skip. Sometimes you decide to crack open a book beside your banana with coffee. Sometimes you decide to continue reading to the next paragraph. The direction is not wholly yours. It was hot last night, and you didn't sleep very well. You are groggy today, which is to say you are acting a certain way because you are feeling a certain way. That banana is smiling at you a little funny, and it takes two cups of coffee for you to feel a sense of control again. Sip, sip. Okay. You are becoming yourself. What happened is the world did something to you. It pulled at you just a little, and you tilted off your course just the smallest bit. It was barely at all, the flap of a butterfly's wings and the august maelstrom of life. But look, what we're talking about here is the opposite of the butterfly effect. There is no marvelous domino amplification of sneezes into tidal waves. No, all we care about for now are the little changes that follow the other little changes. It was hot last night, and here you are, reaching for a little more caffeine. And yes, it is still you who's reaching. The world's not doing that. You still get to make decisions when the world pulls you off course. What I mean is, your storyline still has direction. But there is something else in the room. There is a weight tied to the line of your life, and it points toward Earth. This is a book about your second cup of coffee. It is about the ways in which the natural world tugs and prods at the decisions you make, how it twists and folds your memories and mental states, how this nebulous everywhere we call the environment tips your internal scales. Sometimes these nudges are benign. You snap at your mother on the phone because surely you have had this conversation before, and right now it is 95 degrees Fahrenheit and your patience has run dry. Or maybe it's the air quality that's off kilter today. There's that wildfire across the state, after all, and you have an absolute whopper of a headache, and you simply cannot focus enough to remember if your partner's birthday is January 5 or January 6. You should absolutely know the answer to this question, but is it really the same day as the Capitol Hill riot? That seems too on the nose. And it is not so bad to forget a birthday or snap at your mom. You can remedy those kinds of things, even when it's too hot to sleep. But that is not always the case. Sometimes the world offers more than a nudge. Sometimes it pushes further, and sometimes you are changed forever. The ragged trauma of a hurricane, wildfires that melt people, the interior demons that check into the motel of your mind and never leave and somehow convince you to pick up the tab. There is the abyssal depression that descends with landscape loss, the cortex rotting diseases provoked by warming waters. There are, with us now, brain-eating amoebae and plummeting test scores and the shrunken brains of chronic stress. All this and more. What I am trying to say is, the horrors are not out there. The horrors are inside. Let's start with coffee. We're still waking up.
Indeed. Well, your book is a wake up to us. And talking about that more than a nudge, you write these difficult truths so poetically, and that makes it, I think, easier to read, but is at the same time difficult. You know, Weight of Nature could not come out at a more important time. I believe we're entering the 11th consecutive month where we're breaking global temperature rise. And if this doesn't stabilize by August, they say we're entering uncharted territory. I just so like the premise or what you outline in, you know, clear facts is that climate change, which you talk about environmental change, not just climate change, but is driving us nuts and scientifically impacting the way we think and behave. And it's not just that these are external weather events, the heat waves, the storm surges, the floods, the wildfires that are happening out there in the world. They're somehow affecting our internal weather systems, our adult brains, and even those of unborn children.
Yes, yes. I think that's exactly right. And insofar as we may find ourselves there, I think in many of the natural experiments in which we've found ourselves in terms of these environmental stressors and the manners in which they are affecting our internal weather systems, as you so eloquently phrased it, we're already in uncharted territory, right? We don't know very much about the ultimate effects of a changing climate on our brains, because I think some of those effects we're not going to understand for a few more decades. All we know is that we're in the middle of a grand experiment.
Yeah, it's not nice to be in that middle of the grand experiment. Although I guess for someone who comes from a background of, you know, a master's in public policy, then you want to see, you know, how we can apply it and put out the fires as best we can. Just outline some of those different ways, whether it's like upticks in violence and hate speech, or you talk about the anxiety or the depression, just the different ways in which we're being changed.
Yeah, thanks for that question. It really is a series of effects. And when I use the word series, you know, I mean to say a set of progressions, right? And it's also a set of various spatial scales of effect. So you can think about the extent to which a changing climate is acting on individual cells in the brain. You can think about the manner in which it's acting on behavior, right? And then you can think about the manners in which it's acting on relationships between organisms, whole societal and cultural effects. So to break those down a little more, I think it's actually easiest to start with the individual, because this is our experience, right? This is the closest we have to understanding at an intuitive level the effects in question. You already named the fact that we can experience trauma, we can experience depression and anxiety as a function of a changing climate. I think many folks are familiar with the notion of climate anxiety. That's actually not necessarily what this book is about. I'm more interested in the direct effects of a changing climate on behavior and decision-making and brain health. And when it comes to the individual, like the fact that people are more aggressive in the heat. You've maybe felt this. I certainly have. I'm a little more ornery when it's 95 degrees out instead of 75 degrees out. And that is a universal shared experience, right? People and animals as well are more aggressive in the heat. They're more prone to violence in the heat. They're also less good at solving problems. We make decisions in a more impulsive manner. And so this book dives into the neuroscience of why that might be true. When you think about the cellular level, I often try to understand effects in terms of disease progression. Climate change is expanding the habitable range of brain disease vectors like ticks and mosquitoes and bats, right? And these are vectors that carry viruses and bacteria that cause brain diseases in people. In the same way that air pollution, for example, can cross the blood-brain barrier and instigate neuronal changes that lead to things like neurodegeneration, right? We're talking about micro-scale cellular level effects of environmental stress on the brain. So we've got that to worry about. And then there are what I like to think about as the cultural changes. And the reason that these are in the book as well is because culture arises from our brains. It arises from synchronicities between our brains. It is social neuroscience. And by way of example, I have a chapter at the end of the book on language loss, right? And one of the easiest ways to conceptualize this argument is by thinking of the fact that there are some languages out there in the world that have hundreds and hundreds of words for snow, right? For different types of snow. And yet as the climate changes, some of these words fall out of use by necessity, by the fact that those types of snow no longer exist in the world, right? And so the vocabulary will fade in kind. Now, what does this vocabulary do? What does it allow people to do? It allows them to perceive the world in a specific way, right? It allows them to understand reality with a fine grain. It allows us to categorize the world. It allows us to perceive the world with a specificity that we may not actually notice with our eyes. This is actually something that we are erecting using language. And so as language fades, as vocabulary is lost, literally intergenerationally, our perception of the world is shifting in kind. And so you can see how these cultural touchstones are being lost as well. And I think that's an important facet that we're unfortunately also not paying attention to.
Yeah, we're so used to being able to control our planet with our ingenious machines and tools. But certainly then if you pull out and look into the natural world, which is, of course, part of us, but you look at whales or bees or the way they navigate and communicate on that level of language, it's really affecting them.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And people, of course, are easiest for us to wrap our heads around because that's what we are. And of course, these effects are not limited to people. The neurological effects of the climate crisis are those that, by definition, act on nervous systems. And we're not the only ones with nervous systems. So this is really a shared universal experience and one that extends past the human species. This is the type of interaction that affects anything that seeks to interact with its environment, that seeks to model its environment with a nervous system, because that's what brains do. Brains model the world around them. They prevent the organism with the brain from being surprised. Because if we were constantly in a state of surprise, we would never be able to get anything done. Brains need to offer us an experience of the world that is predictable. And yet, what do we know about climate change? It is a story of unpredictability. It is a story of change, right? It's in the phrase. And so as the world changes, brains must change in kind. And that is true of humans and animals alike.
So we should go into your story, of course. You began as a neuroscientist. So what brought you out of the lab and this more expansive view of being a science communicator journalist?
Well, I found myself working in a neuroscience lab, which was indeed my dream job. I had just gone through graduate school for neuroscience. And there I was looking at a computer screen modeling neural networks effectively. I was a computational neuroscientist. And it didn't seem to me that what I was doing necessarily was on its way toward capturing the essence of the human experience in which I was interested, right? I was interested in brains because this is the organ from which our rich experience of the world arises. Brains are responsible for love. Brains are responsible for sadness. And these profound experiences are those in which I sought to investigate, right? They are the experiences in which I was interested and modeling them in the lab in a computer simply wasn't doing it for me. And so I left neuroscience with the aim of trying to ground some neuroscientific investigations in the broader world as opposed to the confines of a computer screen. What that meant for me in practice is I went into public policy. I went into public policy and then I went into journalism because this is where I felt the rubber to kind of be hitting the road in terms of the relationships between science and society. And I had an editor at the first magazine I worked at, Grist, which is actually the home base to which I have now returned. I still work at Grist. I had an editor who asked me, well, hey, you're a neuroscientist. Surely there is some kind of series to be written on This Is Your Brain on Climate Change or something like that. To which I was quite skeptical at first, right? Neuroscience is one of those fields that is so readily sensationalized. I mean, how many articles have you seen on the internet that start with that phrase, right? And the sensationalism, I think, doesn't always lend itself to treating the science in question with integrity. And so I was worried, in effect, about alienating my former colleagues and looking for something to write about that wasn't actually there. And yet He was my boss. And I said, okay, I'll look into it. And there was something there. And as I continued to pull at the threads of all these manners in which a changing climate is changing us from the inside out, that to me felt like my answer. That to me was the manner in which I could take the neuroscience out of the lab and think about the manners in which it intersects with society writ large and in this, you know, more intuitive, felt, expansive manner. And this book is the result of the 6 or 7 years of research that followed.
And speaking of a changing climate, changing us from the inside out, we now have another type of neural network landscape in the form of artificial intelligence, which is also affecting the way we think and perceive the world.
Yes, I think that's right. You know, you mentioned artificial intelligence, and I was having a conversation with a colleague the other day who asked me, well, hey, surely there's something to be said for the manners in which technology is mediating our relationship with nature, mediating both our relationship with knowledge, as you suggest, Mia, and I think also mediating our relationship with nature. How might you understand those technological effects in light of some of these environmental stressors that you're writing about? And, you know, I hate to give an obnoxious answer there, but I do think it's along the lines of kids are looking at their phones too much. I think it is kind of along the lines of the classic argument against technology preventing us from interacting with the world writ large, preventing us from felt human experience. One of the things that folks have understood about the world for a very long time, and now more recently in neuroscientific terms, is that exposure to nature is actually quite good for us. So I write a lot about all the dangers of a changing climate and how environmental stressors are impacting our brain health. But we have modes of getting out of these funks. And one of those, perhaps paradoxically, is convening with nature. Green space is wildly neuroprotective. There's a reason that there are lifespan differences between different parts of a city. And green space is one of those effects, one of those motivating effects. And so when I think about technology and its ability to separate us from nature, separate us from curiosity sometimes, I do worry about the manners in which it is preventing us from realizing some of the neurocognitive benefits of being out there in the world without that type of mediation.
Yes. As much as you're reminding us of those hard truths, this book is very poetically written, and it connects us and invites us to have those experiences with nature. You know, we talk a lot about the 15-minute city. We should be regreening our cities a lot more for obvious reasons. As people continue to migrate to urban areas, access to green spaces drops drastically, which, as we know, affects not just our stress levels and mental well-being. On the other hand, there's always problems with gentrification and those projects that uproot and push people out. I also want to go into your other book on homelessness. But first, on that point of journalism, I'm interested to know your reflections on the future of journalism. How do you see it evolving in the changing AI and digital landscape? And could you just discuss some of your work at Grist and how you use data journalism to uncover environmental injustices?
Yeah, happy to. I should say that I'm not a Luddite. I do use technology. And in fact, I use quite a bit of it in my day job at Grist. So I am a data reporter at this magazine. And what does that mean? It implies that I'm building statistical models of phenomena. I'm writing web scrapers and building data visualizations. I have a quite technical job in terms of my relationship with the field of journalism. I just don't think that those tools ought to be put on some kind of pedestal and framed as the be-all, end-all of the possibility of the field, right? I think that data science, artificial intelligence, the advent of these new LLMs, they're useful tools to add to the journalistic toolkit, but they can't supersede the traditional tools of investigative reporting, right? Beat reporting, hitting the ground, archival research, public records requests, interviewing real people, right? This is the stuff that is always going to undergird a good story, right? You can't have a good story without a relationship with a person. And as much as I want to wring out humanity from a spreadsheet, I'm never going to be able to get to personhood from a spreadsheet. So, you know, I think your question about the future of journalism is a great one. Journalism is at a challenging moment, right? You are perhaps familiar with the waves and waves of layoffs that the field has been experiencing over the past couple months. And I think something like artificial intelligence, as a nice example, is one of those advents that offers both possibility and uncertainty to people working in the field. We don't know what the ultimate effect of AI is going to be on journalism. But I think journalism is maybe going to look a little bit different in 20 years. And so what is my thought on the future of the field? I suppose that we're at somewhat of a crossroads, somewhat of a moment of introspection and uncertainty. I still believe deeply in the principles of journalism and the necessity of the field. But I do think it's potentially true that it might look a little different in a few years.
Yeah, well, we still need those human stories, although it's getting pretty good at replicating that, I have to say. Every few months I'm seeing that I had to orientate my thinking about it because I didn't think that it would be as creative so quickly.
Yeah, I don't think anybody did.
Perhaps we could go back a bit. Tell us about the stress pregnancy study done after Hurricane Sandy, how the trauma and stress factors affected the cognitive development in children born around that time.
Yeah, happy to. The effects in question, they aren't limited to people who are alive today. That's kind of one of the other unfortunate parts here, right? You don't even need to have been born to experience something like the trauma of a hurricane. There's this very, very interesting study out of New York in which these researchers were studying expecting mothers who were carrying children when Hurricane Sandy came into town in 2012. And the researchers had already begun to collaborate with hundreds of pregnant women in the city, trying to understand the relationship between stress, as broadly defined, and maternal child health outcomes. And all of a sudden comes into town one of the greatest stressors possible, right? A hurricane. And so the researchers split their cohort effectively into two halves, one of whom consisted of mothers and their unborn children who were in utero during the storm. And the other half, those who were either born prior to Sandy or conceived after the storm. And then they followed the children as they grew up. And in a 10-year look back on these children, right? So this study that was published in 2022, they found that the neuropsychiatric health of the kids who had been in utero during the storm was drastically compromised relative to the other children, right? The children who were in utero during Sandy had a wildly increased risk of anxiety, depression, ADHD, conduct disorder. And these were conditions with symptoms that were presenting as early as preschool. And to me, this is just another example of the fact that when we think about environmental stressors, when we think about exposure to trauma, right? Because that's what a hurricane is. A hurricane is trauma. We can't just consider the present generation, because we know that there is an entire epigenetic science of intergenerational trauma. These effects can be transferred to the next generation. And so I think it's that kind of science that, to me, really raises the stakes here. We're not just talking about people who are alive today.
Indeed, and it's all interconnected. Of course, it affects those in the global south more than in the global north, and it affects, there's a lot of intersectionality around this, and it affects those who you've written about homelessness. Why is homelessness a housing problem that you wrote in your other book? Could you just go into that and why it's not just a poverty problem? There's many different things at play.
Yeah, of course. You know, prior to moving back to my work at Grist, I spent some time in the public sector working indeed on homelessness and housing. And after leaving the public sector, I kept a foot in the academy and I was working with a fabulous colleague at the University of Washington named Greg Colburn. And Greg had brought me this idea of, you know, effectively a lay audience statistical investigation of homelessness. It's so commonly understood in many different manners, right? Everybody has an opinion on what causes someone to lose their housing. We hear examples like extreme poverty is the root of homelessness. We hear examples like substance use or mental illness are the cause of homelessness. And what Greg wanted to do is stress test these notions, right? Gather up a statistical cohort of 25-30 of the country's largest cities, all of which have different per capita rates of homelessness, and ask, what is it that explains the variance? What is it that explains the difference between them? And again, what we found is that it wasn't the classic explanations in terms of what you hear on the nighttime news. It wasn't a story of substance use. It wasn't a story even of poverty. Instead, the predictive factors, those that explained the variance across cities and across time, they all had to do with the housing market, right? How much was rent in a given city? What is the vacancy rate? How many units are available to rent in a given city? That's what could explain the relationship between some kind of economic variable and the rate of homelessness observed in a region. And so that resulted in the title of the book, which is Homelessness is a Housing Problem. And if you give it a read, I think you'll see it is exactly that. We seek to show that the classic explanations of homelessness tend not to carry any water if you hold up that statistical lens really. And perhaps intuitively, this is a problem of housing markets.
As you expanded on, you recently led a data analysis and program evaluation team for homelessness programs at Pierce County, Washington. How do you think climate change will uniquely impact the homeless population in the future? And are we already seeing the effects now?
That's a very insightful question. I mean, what we do know about people experiencing homelessness is that they're, of course, at risk for a great number of environmental exposures to which other members of the population who may be housed perhaps can escape. So when we think about the effects of a changing climate, certainly this is a universal shared experience insofar as all of us in time are going to come into contact with the types of stressors that I write about in this book. And also, if you're sleeping outside, almost by definition, you're going to be exposed to more of them. And I'm not just talking about climate change. I'm also talking about air pollution, diesel exhaust, right? Noise pollution. All of these environmental stressors have relationships with the brain. And if you are spending more time comparatively enmeshed in them, well, you are too going to have a corresponding disproportionate response. And what we do know, right, I don't know if there have been any studies per se on what I just said, but what we do know is that in terms of cardiovascular health or respiratory health or indeed mental health, very frequently to be living in such extreme conditions, right, to not have a roof over one's head, it's a huge risk factor for the development of those types of conditions.
Yeah, for sure. And you also have an extensive background in public policy. How do you think we can best implement public policy to recognize the needs of these homeless people?
I think it starts with accounting. Frankly, we do not know by definition what we don't know. This is the classic like Rumsfeld quote or something, but it's true. We're at a moment right now where we're just beginning to get a sense of what we might be exposed to as a population going forward. And so the same is true of these potential disproportionate effects on people who are in the most vulnerable positions, right? We have a sense of what these exposures look like. We have a sense of what they might imply over time, but nobody's bothering to actually write this stuff down and run the cost-benefit analyses that might allow us to respond appropriately. Climate policy kind of runs on cost-benefit analysis. You know, we live in a capitalist society, and governments, when they look at something like climate action or climate adaptation, deploying solar panels, building seawalls, right, instituting worker protections in the heat, all that kind of stuff that can help solve the crisis or at least prevent its worst effects, all of those decisions are predicated on those investments being quote-unquote worth it. Right. So what does it mean for something to be worth it? It means the benefits have to outweigh the costs. If we're not taking neurological health into account, if we're not taking, right, these neurocognitive deficits into account that are arising as a function of air pollution exposure and exposure to extreme heat and extreme weather, if we are not pricing those effects, we have no chance of responding to them appropriately, because it's never going to seem like it's worth justifying a response. And one of the chapters in my new book is about blue-green algae, cyanobacteria. And cyanobacteria appear to be releasing a neurotoxin that is one of the most compelling causal explanators for the development of ALS, right? This is Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a horrifying neurodegenerative disease. But the way ALS manifests is not like you take a whiff of a cyanobacteria bloom and then you catch this condition the next day, right? It takes years to manifest. And so we're at this moment now where I think we're also failing to price both the present day effects and the future effects of these exposures. ALS, tremendously expensive to treat. And also, we're not aware of the ultimate burden the collective disease is going to place on society till decades in the future, because the exposures that folks are experiencing today potentially won't manifest for years. And yet we have statistical models that can help us project what might happen, that can help us begin to internalize some of these costs and price them accordingly. And I think that if we can start there, if we can start from a place of careful accounting, that is our absolute best bet at governments justifying the responses that are necessary to protect the most vulnerable in society.
Indeed. And then just to go into some of those other ways that climate change may be affecting us, you mentioned ALS, but Alzheimer's and ADHD, possibly autism.
Yeah, this is some really disturbing evidence, but it's all there, right? We know, for example, that if expecting mothers are exposed to extreme heat in, I believe, the first trimester of pregnancy, the risk of their children developing schizophrenia and anorexia skyrockets, right? This is just ambient heat exposure resulting in an increased risk of a neuropsychiatric condition. I think air pollution is probably the most well understood neurodegenerative vector that we have. People have been studying the effects of particulate matter on the brain for years. And why do I care about this? Why do I write about this in my book? Well, this particulate matter, this PM2.5, the air pollution in question, it results from the burning of fossil fuels, right? So it's connected to the climate problem very intimately insofar as it is a cause of the climate problem. Air pollution, it can enter the brain effectively through the nasal nerve. You breathe it in and it can kind of hitch a ride all the way up to the brain. And what does it do there? Scientists are beginning to understand that it results in this kind of low-level chronic inflammation. And inflammation is the beginning of so many diseases. In fact, most diseases under the sun have some kind of inflammatory response or inflammatory predicate. And in the case of neurodegeneration, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, right? We mentioned ALS, various forms of dementias. The concern there is that this low-grade chronic inflammation is that which ultimately triggers some of these neurodegenerative pathways. And so there, again, you see this environmental vector kind of worming its way into us, right? Seeping, you know, kind of past our defenses, sneaking and seeping past our defenses. And in the long term, resulting in the increased risk of a really destructive and emotionally devastating set of diseases.
Certainly in the so-called developed world, diseases caused by inflammation are greater than, it's no longer famine for us, it's these cancers. But I'm curious on the note of, you know, your ideas for the solutions. How can we take action as we think, you know, we're living in the century of the city in terms of public policy, what things that you think can be made this decade of transformation? Because we think about smart cities, smart buildings. So many people have no idea where their future is going. So as you think about those key areas, say urban planning and all these adaptation efforts that need to take place, what are your reflections?
Well, from a planning perspective, green space really matters, right? Green space matters, as we discussed when we were talking about phones, and air filtration really matters, right? We just spoke a bit about the potential effects of air pollution on the brain. Having these stopgap mechanisms in place to protect us inside our buildings, right, in the built environment, are going to be tremendously useful going forward. They're not the solution per se. Air conditioning is not going to solve the climate crisis. In fact, it's probably only going to result in the continued burning of fossil fuels if we continue to air condition our buildings in the way that we currently are. And yet, it's going to be life-saving in many capacities. So we need systems in the built environment that offer people clean air, clean water, right? Access to temperate environments. And we need the built environment to allow for exposures to clean air, clean water, and temperate environments to the extent that it can. It looks like tree-lined streets. It looks like, as you suggested, walkable cities, right? All of the vectors by which we know engaging with nature can confer neurocognitive benefit, so many of them can be enhanced in our cities through careful planning decisions. And I think if we're not taking those steps going forward, you know, it's given the evidence base, really a dereliction of duty. I'd mentioned the notion of life expectancy differences earlier. I'm based in Seattle and I haven't looked at the numbers super lately, but I know relatively recently, if you looked at the difference between like South Seattle and North Seattle, you saw something on the order of like a 10-year life expectancy difference, which is the result of various exposures to particulate matter, right? And the urban heat island effect. It's all the manners in which our planning decisions around density and green space and traffic and noise pollution ultimately bear on our health.
And I think that that's one of those areas where we're willing to give up some of our autonomy to AI that might balance in terms of our energy grid, maybe make it more efficient. And that is one way I think that AI can be used positively.
Yes. And again, I don't need to, you know, speak too negatively of the development of these types of technologies. I use artificial intelligence in my reporting all the time, right? I'm a data scientist. I train statistical models using algorithmic modes of approaching data science. And so certainly, I think there's a lot of promise in using these technological developments for good. I think the challenge is, you know, figuring out what is the definition of the good and how can we align these technologies with that definition.
Hi, I'm Mia Pardini, a student at the University of Washington studying environmental studies and climate science. What I appreciate about this conversation was Aldern's various unique perspectives on climate change. As we've learned in this interview, Aldern has a master's in public policy, neuroscience, and is currently working in data science. The average person may not think of these three things and correlate them with climate change, but I think that's part of what makes it so important. In my major, I've learned the importance of interdisciplinary studies contributing to the fight against climate change. This is because climate change is more than what initially meets the eye. It's technically a scientific change, but the causes and the effects are greatly determined by political and social factors. What we have done to cause climate change and what we must do to mitigate it is strongly determined by the effectiveness of public policy. Climate change has been impacting us neuroscientifically as well. In this interview, I found that Aldern was educational, but also really honest about how they think climate change will impact us in terms of mental health. Aldern has mentioned diseases such as ALS, ADHD, depression, and anxiety, which many people may not initially correlate with climate change whatsoever, but Aldern provides a unique perspective on it. His background in neuroscience shows that he has a true passion for this research and understands that climate change cannot simply be changing the weather. It has to be changing our brain in some ways too. In my relatively short lifetime, I've already noticed a lot of changes in myself, friends, and family members. Disregarding the political polarization it's caused many people throughout this country, I've also noticed the people around me being a little bit more anxious every year when it comes to weather. This definitely relates to news headlines which have doomsday titles like hottest year on record or climate change will only get worse from here, etc. Titles and news reporting like this makes many people, including myself, anxious about our future. Many have become too scared to have any hope or desire to help. This is also where Clayton's experience in data science comes in, and he is currently working at Grist magazine, which I find fairly accessible for anyone to get updated on climate news. Grist reports on topics like politics, energy, equity, solutions, and how they intersect with climate. This is very helpful as it emphasizes that climate change has multiple causes and multiple solutions. Aldern explains that data science can be used to accurately report what changes in our climate, which must be done to inform our population. What I especially liked about what Aldern was talking about is that data science can't capture everything about journalism. True journalism has to include conversations, talking to people who can provide insight and a compelling story. This is where I think climate change reporting could be changed. We should interview people who are being disproportionately impacted by climate change, leaders in environmental policy, and more, to get a bigger picture of how global warming is changing our society. Now back to the interview. Yeah, so as a student at the University of Washington, I was really excited to learn that you're currently working at the Center for Studies in Demography and Ecology. How is the work related to climate change research?
That's a fabulous question. So, you know, to clarify, I'm what they call a research affiliate. And so I work for myself effectively, and I am affiliated with the university. And this program is a really beautiful one because it means that affiliates like me don't necessarily need to be Seattle-based per se. The affiliate program has representatives all over the country. And so when I think about, you know, the contributions that folks are making to research in Seattle, I do think that CSDE is this excellent model wherein we're bringing all kinds of great thinkers together on one set of problems in one locality. So we think about demography, right? We think about geography. And I think importantly, we think about the ecological relationships with those types of fields. So you can at this center see conversations materializing between people like me, again, an ex-neuroscientist, and again, my colleague I mentioned earlier, Greg Colburn, who teaches at the university in the real estate department. He's a housing economist who comes from a background in investment banking and made a pit stop for a PhD in sociology at the University of Minnesota. And so you've got an ex-investment banking sociologist studying housing markets, having conversations with ex-neuroscientist environmental journalists. And the collaborations that can result from those types of conversations, I think, are really powerful.
Indeed, with the increasing intersectionality of all this is so important. What were some of the most startling or interesting things that you found out in the writing of Weight of Nature?
I have to say, I think that the relationship between cyanobacteria and ALS was a really surprising and deeply troubling one. I have studied neurodegeneration a little bit in my career, mostly with respect to Parkinson's. And the thing about neurodegenerative disease is that very little of the incidence of these diseases can be explained by genetics, right? It's usually for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or ALS, it's like 5% of cases are genetic. The other 90, 95%, they're called sporadic cases. That kind of just means we don't know where they came from. We understand the types of risky behaviors and the types of risky exposures that might have a relationship with neurodegeneration, but it's really difficult to ever say X causes Y, you know, in the same way that we understand how gravity works. And yet, here was a decades-long investigation by this researcher named Paul Allen Cox. He's an ethnobotanist who runs this nonprofit called Brain Chemistry Labs in Jackson Hole. And Cox had been working, you know, again, since I think perhaps the 80s on this question of how exposure to this specific molecule that he had actually found in cycad trees, right, in cycad nuts, how it was finding its way into people's brains and how these people's brains started to look as if neurodegeneration was occurring. And especially since cycad trees aren't particularly common, right, they, for example, are in Guam, but they're not in British Columbia, where in a brain bank, he was finding this toxin and he was finding resulting neurodegeneration, right? He realized, man, this is a cyanotoxin. It's produced by a cyanobacteria. Cyanobacteria are pretty much everywhere, right? They're in freshwater all around the world. They can live in crusts in the desert. They don't need a lot of water to survive. They just need to be hydrated every once in a while. This is a ubiquitous organism that's been around for billions of years. And by no fault of its own, it's producing this toxin that appears to have one of the most compelling causal pathways for the development of neurodegeneration. And so to me, this is a story that is a little bit classic in terms of the scientist who isn't listened to. That's kind of the trope. And he's had to, you know, build this case over decades and gotten laughed out of so many rooms. But now people are coming around to his research and realizing that his observations have stood the test of time. And so this to me is, you know, both a worrying development, a surprising development insofar as I wouldn't have been able to guess or surmise, you know, 2 years ago that I was going to be writing about blue-green algae blooms producing a neurotoxin that causes neurodegeneration. I think it's also somewhat indicative of the fact that the scientific method works, right? This was the result of careful observation over decades and collaboration between scientists who remained, I think, healthily skeptical of their surprising findings. They effectively sought to disprove themselves over and over again until they couldn't.
Yes, and we don't know how many new and ancient viruses will emerge with the melting of ice caps and glaciers.
We have to open our eyes, as you say, and to face these important truths. You know, you begin the book talking about the future and the possibility of children born into the world we live today. What have been your reflections on a lot of us have just not had children, not wanting to welcome them into this world as it is now?
Yeah, and many people will continue to make that decision. My perspective is people caused the climate crisis, and it will be people together who solve it. And so I do think that future generations will feel the brunt of some of these stressors, right? They're going to feel the brunt of some of this trauma. And I also think that we need to continue to bring people into the world because it is going to be future minds in collaboration with our own that ultimately solve the problem. A decades-long effort to understand the relationship between cyanobacteria and neurodegeneration, that type of effort can't succeed unless there's a through line through the research over the decades. And that through line can't exist unless you have young people becoming scientists, young people concerned with these issues going on to work in these fields as well. And so I do think that it's going to get worse before it gets better, and that people who are born today, people who are born in a decade, are by definition going to be born into a warmer world. And yet I think it's incumbent on us to take the even longer view, to think about the future of this. And I think when you take that perspective, it's incumbent on us to protect those far future relatives. And that is going to require deeper collaboration and further thought and hard work. And it is not only going to be for our generation to solve.
Yes, indeed. It's an intergenerational story. You know, you say you're a romantic, and I really feel that because you couldn't care this much without having a romance for the world, what it could be, human potential. And, you know, makes me wonder about you as a young person. You know, what gave you this curiosity and sense of mission and purpose?
What a question. Not one I've ever really bothered asking myself. You know, my mother is an artist. She's an acrylic painter. And I think growing up surrounded by art and surrounded by her practice was by definition that which introduced me to creativity. And I think creativity is often just another word for curiosity. It is a mode by which we express our curiosities about the world and about our interiority. And so I think certainly exposure to art at a young age, exposure to the creative process at a young age, is probably that which afforded me a certain sympathy to those tools and those modes of exploring the world later in life. You know, when I think about the act of writing, when I think about the types of reflection that I'm doing in these pages, that is to me an act of curiosity. That is to me an investigation into questions I have about the world that I don't see answers to elsewhere that I believe are worth attempting to think through. And, you know, I write in the book that I don't profess any kind of moral clarity here. I'm just trying to figure this stuff out. I'm trying to work through these questions on the page. We are in uncharted territory. I think it's our curiosity that's going to get us out of it.
Yes, imagine new worlds. And writing the arts hand in hand with the sciences are a way to imagine and get us out of the situation that we're currently in. And as you reflect on the future, could you share some of your reflections on the beauty and wonder of the natural world?
I would be happy to, because it is that beauty that wonder, that awe, that I think ultimately is that which affords us coming out of these horrors with a sense of resilience. I'm often asked the question, what gives you hope? And I actually don't really care much for the notion of hope. I think that hope can breed a kind of complacency. I'm much more interested in desire. I'm much more interested in painting a picture of a world that we want and then figuring out how to make that world come into focus, come into reality. What does that world look like to me? Where do I see hints or suggestions at what it could be? What is it that inspires desire within me? It's exactly what you suggested. It's awe and wonder and beauty. I want to be wowed by the world. I want to gaze at it in awe and wonder. And it's so easy to do so, I think, when we take a step back and begin to appreciate the complexity of the interactions around us, right? Complexity is very beautiful. We've talked a lot about, right, all the manners in which a changing environment is reaching in and changing us. That's scary, but I think it's also, in a sense, really beautiful insofar as here we're taking note of a very porous boundary between the self and the rest of the world. We are literally observing our enmeshment in our environment. We are self-conscious selves coming to understand the fact that we are not somehow walled off from the rest of the world, and unbelievably beautiful. And so I think if we can begin to reframe some of these frightening relationships as profoundly intimate relationships that certainly require addressing, but I would argue more importantly on the relationships themselves, on the intimacy and the porousness themselves, it's that kind of reference frame shift that I think is going to help us move out of some of the darkness.
Well, I can really hear your humanistic principles, or I should say your embracing of all animal kind in that. I'm so glad that you did choose to leave the lab and open up our eyes and a greater window onto the world, because it helps us connect with our purpose. So thank you, Clayton Aldern, for helping us understand our relationship with the environment and come to terms with this changing world, for an understanding the ways planetary health is linked to public health. We don't have to be burdened by the weight of nature. We can collectively change our ways and paint a picture of the world we want. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me. It's been an honor.
One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Mia Pardini with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Mia Pardini. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.